Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. A very blessed Holy Week to you and to all of yours. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. We'll continue with open forum this hour. I'll tell you right now, every single line's full. You can give us a call, and as lines open up, we'll get you in. 888-318-7884. Open forum means open to anyone, and especially when Jimmy's here, anything. Ask what you like. Jimmy Akins, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akins' Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy. Thanks for being here with us.
Hello, Cyril Kellett. Glad to be here with you.
You know this, I had something I was going to ask you about right when I came back, and then it just slipped my mind. But I'll ask you about what's dropping this week on Jimmy Akins' Mysterious World on Friday.
So this is an episode we'd normally do on a fifth Friday, but last Friday, which was a fifth Friday, was also the day before April 1st.
Oh.
And it's a tradition that we do April Fool's episode at this time of year. So I did one last Friday about Emperor Norton I, the Emperor of the United States of America and the Protector of Mexico. And I like to keep the listeners guessing about what's going on in April Fool's episode. So last year for the April Fool's episode, I told a story that was wild, but absolutely true.
Oh, isn't that funny?
It was about a guy who married a ghost. And so, and then came to doubt whether he was genuinely married and wanted the courts to adjudicate it. And so he sued the medium that brokered the marriage. And it was absolutely true. I was not making anything up. I was not exaggerating. I was not misdirecting. And so I didn't want to go back immediately to something where traditionally what I've done is everything I say is absolutely true, but highly misleading. And I didn't want to just revert to type, and I wanted the listeners to have to think. So I told a story about Joshua Abram Norton, who was an immigrant to the United States in the 1800s. He lived in San Francisco, and he declared himself Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. And he published imperial decrees in the newspapers. He conducted diplomatic relations, such as with the Kingdom of Hawaii, who recognized him as the legitimate ruler of America. He issued his own currency, which was accepted at restaurants and so forth in San Francisco. And I was not making anything up. All of this was true.
No.
This all really happened. Yeah. So, so that's what we did last week. But since we were doing an April Fool's episode, it displaced what we'd normally do on a fifth Friday, which is weird questions.
Okay,
and
good.
And so this Friday, we're going to have our weird questions episode. We're going to be talking about things like if you're a vampire, can you commit suicide to prevent yourself from predating on others? We're also going to talk about time travel, watching ghost hunting TV shows, the Left Behind series of books, and more.
I know about your very high opinion of ghost hunting TV shows. I say sarcastically.
So, yes. I do not have a high opinion of. I'm interested in real paranormal investigations, not what they do on amateurish, inept, ridiculous ghost hunting shows.
One thing I've never asked you, but it just occurs to me to ask you this. You know, the original movie Ghostbusters, did any of the language that they use, was it actually taken from, like, they didn't make up all those things, or was all their paranormal language borrowed from the real paranormal field?
It's largely made up. They did have some some real elements from parapsychology in it. Like, there's a scene early on in the movie where Bill Murray is conducting a test using what are sometimes called Zener cards or ESP cards. And these are cards that have very simple shapes on them, like square, circle, triangle, star, and wavy lines.
Okay.
Those are the five shapes on Zener cards. And those were actually invented by a real parapsychologist in the mid-20th century. His name was J.B. Rhine, and also a guy named Zener. They invented them at the Duke University Parapsychology Lab in North Carolina at Duke University. And so they have historically been used to test things like telepathy, precognition, and clairvoyance. There are different ways you use them depending on the kind of test you want to do. But they historically, they're not used very much these days, but they historically have been used, and they picked up on that in Ghostbusters. But a lot of the other stuff they had, like electro guns to capture spirits and class 5 vaporous apparitions and stuff, all of that was made up.
What but about ectoplasm? Did, is that a real thing?
No, ectoplasm is something that's actually reported. That's also from parapsychology.
Oh, okay.
Ectoplasm is reported, and there's a lot of skepticism about ectoplasm because there were so many fakes among physical mediums in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But they would emit this substance, which was supposed to be of a spiritual nature, and it could become concrete, and so it was called ectoplasm. But there's a lot of skepticism because people photographed it or got to touch it and said, this is just cheesecloth, guys. This is a trick. But Ghostbusters did have an impact on the on some paranormal investigators, because when it came out in 1984, it brought a lot of attention to this. And so actual paranormal investigators started getting calls from people who thought their location, for example, might be haunted. I know one paranormal investigator who was contacted shortly after Ghostbusters, when it was, you know, still in the theaters. There was a house that seemed to have a spirit in it, that the spirit was seen by the parents and talked regularly with a young boy in the household. The spirit seemed very friendly. It was apparently the ghost of the previous owner. And when they called my friend in, who investigated this case, one of the things the ghost was very concerned about, because Ghostbusters was in the theater at the time, was did he have any devices he was going to use to blast or trap her? And he assured them that no, that technology does not exist. We are not going to attempt to blast or trap the spirit. So the spirit doesn't need to be concerned about that.
That's a great question. Unless the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man shows up.
Then you need more advanced technology.
888-318-7884 is the number. Off we go to Peoria, Illinois. David, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. I'm sorry. I had trouble getting him on the air. But David, are you there with us? No? All right. Hang on, David. There's something funny going on with that line. Don't worry. We'll come back to you. I'll make sure that we get you back. Let's go instead to Daryl in Columbus, Ohio, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Daryl, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. I got nothing on the phones. Nothing's working. I'll tell you what. Tell you what we'll do. We'll this perfect time to take a break anyways. I was kind of pushing the limit. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll have these phones figured out. If you're on the line, hang on the line. We're going to get you on with Jimmy Akin momentarily on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, friends. Jonet Williams here. Join me every Wednesday on Women of Grace Live as I welcome New Age researcher and blogger for Women of Grace, Sue Brinkman. Sue and I will be talking about all the wacky things that could distract you from your faith. Psychics, yoga, Reiki, crystals, acupuncture, Ouija boards, tarot cards, and astral traveling are just a few of the stranger things we discuss. That's why we call it Wacky Wednesday. So join us tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. We've got four new books for the spring here at Catholic Answers Press. The New Relativism from our apologist, Carlo Broussard. The Heart of the Gospel, about the Beatitudes from Father Sebastian Walsh, the words set in stone, Dave Armstrong's look at what archaeology and science are uncovering in regard to the Bible, and then When Protestants Argue Like Atheists, the new book from Trent Horn. I mention all those because they're all on sale today over at shop.catholic.com. It's spring sale time. There's hundreds of other things on sale. Just visit shop.catholic.com. We don't actually know what's going on with the phone, so I'm going to try it again. We'll see if we can get David in Peoria on here. David, are you there with us? All right, I'll tell you what I'm going to have to do. Edgar has written out at least part of what David intended to ask. David, I'm sorry I can't get you on the air. I'm just going to read the questions to Jimmy till we can figure out what's going on with the phones. David asks, can you help me understand salvation history, especially regarding substitutionary atonement?
Okay, so let's start by defining our terms. Salvation history is the process of historical development of God's plan, which of course involves salvation. So it's a historical process and it involves salvation, and that's why it's called salvation history. And it involves different stages. So we read about kind of the primordial stage of salvation history after the fall of man in the early chapters of Genesis. Then we encounter the figure of Abraham, who will become the ancestor of God's chosen people, Israel. We move forward through the age of the patriarchs to the actual birth of the patriarch Israel, whose birth name was Joseph, but he came to be called Israel, who is then the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. And they go down to Egypt in an event that has a very interesting name. Do you happen to know the name of the event where they go down to Egypt? Sykehelet?
I'm thinking. Do I? No, then that is called the Exodus.
Close. Oh. Pretty close. So the event where they come out of Egypt is called what?
Exodus.
The Exodus. So Exodus means departure in Greek. And the prefix ek is on the front of it. Ek means out of. So if you wanted to talk about them coming out of Egypt, you would use Exodus. But if you want to talk about them going into Egypt, you would use a different preposition. The preposition for in or into in Greek is eis, E-I-S, eis. Oh. So the going into Egypt is called the Exodus. So the Exodus is when they come into Egypt. The Exodus is when they come out of Egypt.
Ah, very good.
And of course, at the time of the Exodus, God gave them the lawgiver Moses, who codified the civil and ritual life of Israel by giving them the code of law known as the Torah, and that governed the life of the Jewish community for 1,000 years. We then come up to David, who is the prefigurement of the Messiah, King David. Eventually, the prophets start giving prophecies saying there's going to be a greater son of David who's going to be coming and who will be God's son, and he will be ruler, and he will redeem mankind. And that brings us to the second concept that David asked about, which is substitutionary atonement. Now, atonement is one of the very few theological words that comes from English. Normally, our theological terms come from Greek or maybe Latin. But atonement has English roots, and you can see the roots just by breaking the word apart. If you look at the word atonement, it has three different parts. At, one, meant. And meant is a something we use in English to indicate a condition or a making of something. And so what atonement is making God and man at one, meaning they're on the same team, they're on the same side, they're not in opposition to each other, they are reconciled with each other. And if I were to use a Latinate word that meant atonement, I would probably use something like reconciliation. So that's what atonement is. It's reconciling parties that used to be in opposition and now are not anymore. So Jesus made atonement for us. But how did he do that? How did he reconcile us with God? Well, he did it using substitution. And so this is why we refer to this form of atonement as substitutionary atonement, because Christ was our substitute. We, being finite creatures, could not pay the price of our sins in a finite amount of time. That's why hell goes on forever, because if you're going to pay the price of an infinite sin, like a sin against an infinite all-holy God, then it's going to take an infinite amount of time. And so we can't pay the price of our sins. We can't ultimately, from the ultimate perspective, we can't merit anything from God. And so Christ merited our salvation and forgiveness on our behalf. He, being God himself, being an infinite, you know, being infinitely, infinitely holy God, he could both merit on our behalf, meaning he perform an act that God owes a reward to, and he could pay a price that would be worth the infinite value of our sins against God. And so that's what he did. He offered himself on the cross as a sacrifice of love on our behalf. Because of his and his Father's love for us, he paid a price that was adequate to cover for all of our sins, so we didn't have to pay that price. He paid it on our behalf, and therefore he was our substitute. So we didn't pay the price, he did. And that's why it's called substitutionary atonement. So that's a general sketch, both of salvation history and the role of substitutionary atonement in it.
And I think we can hear the phones now. David, did you get all that?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Hey! Yes, I got that. That was helpful. Could you also help me, because I'm coming from a Protestant background, I'm going to be entering the church, and I'm trying to disentangle some of the areas where we mesh and areas where there's divergent understanding. I'm especially struggling a lot of times when I read chapter 53 of Isaiah, verses 4 through 12, and then, you know, Galatians 3:13 and things like that. Within the Protestant understanding, a lot of times, especially like Calvinism and things, it's God is working with Christ to punish him on our behalf. But I was wondering what the sacrifice is. It's more of love within the Catholic Church, and I'm trying to understand that. Can you help just untangle that for me a little bit?
Yeah, so the specific form of atonement that you're talking about is a kind of substitutionary atonement. Catholics do believe in substitutionary atonement, but in, as you say, in Calvinist circles, there is a specific idea known as penal satisfaction that is a kind of a subtype of substitutionary atonement. Penal means punishment, and satisfaction means satisfaction. So the idea is, on the Calvinist view, that the way substitutionary atonement works is God literally punishes Jesus, and that satisfies his justice so that he can make atonement. And that view is not well received in the Catholic Church. I don't know that I can say it contradicts church teaching, but it is not the standard understanding. And I think there are good reasons for that. You do have one passage in Scripture that seemed, that could be read as indicating penal satisfaction, and that's Isaiah 53, because in Isaiah 53, the suffering servant is spoken of in a way that could suggest punishment. You know, we are healed by his stripes. God has laid on him, you know, the punishment of us all, things like that. That language could be read as God is literally punishing the suffering servant. But we're dealing with prophecy here. and prophecy, not to say Hebrew speech in general, frequently uses non-literal language. And so there's a question we have to ask of, is this punishment language in this passage meant literally or not? And if you think about it, well, punishing Jesus wouldn't make a lot of sense because Jesus is infinitely holy. He's completely innocent. And to punish an innocent person in the proper literal sense of punishment would be unjust. And, you know, you don't punish the innocent. You punish the guilty, and Jesus is not guilty. So since God is just, whatever God did to Jesus couldn't be punishment in the literal sense. And that's also why most of the time when you are reading the Bible, including New Testament discussions of what Jesus did, you normally don't find punishment language in them. That's the outlier case. What you normally find is other language about, in particular, sacrifice. That's the dominant understanding in the New Testament of what Jesus did for us. You also have other language about Jesus saying, like, I offer my life for the sins of many, you know, things like that. So you have other language and other images that are used. The punishment language does get used at least rarely, but given the difficulty of the idea of punishing an infinite, all-holy person, and that seeming to be patently unjust, most Catholic thinkers throughout history have not believed in penal substitution, but they have believed in penal satisfaction, but they have believed in substitutionary atonement.
And I'm going to leave that there. I hope that was helpful to you, David. Lots of folks on the line. Phone's working now, so on we go to Columbus, Ohio. Daryl, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Are you there with us, Daryl?
Yes, I am, and I can hear you.
Very good. That's nice to have you here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Now, first-time caller for anything on EWTN. I am a recent convert. I was baptized Lutheran and spent most of my life in Methodist churches, so I'm coming at it from a little different perspective. But I have a friend who is not the preacher, but the head of a small group church, just a Christian non-denominational group, about a dozen people. But he's been complaining about me that Catholics are so evil because they put Mary before Jesus or God, and they pray to the saints instead of praying directly to God, and so on and so forth. And the way I understand it, and from what I get from the directions on what the church believes and how we should conduct ourselves, et cetera, is that we are praying to the saints. For example, I have St. Florian and St. Catherine, and that I regularly ask them for assistance to pray for something that's particularly troubling me. But I also ask other people who are near me and my friends and such who are still living to do the same. And I really don't see any difference. And I don't believe it's meant that there is a difference, that we're asking them to pray with us for the assistance. We're not praying to them.
Okay.
Really big distinctions. Am I wrong in this?
I got you.
You are not wrong in this. And what we're doing when we ask the saints for our intercession, and by the way, that's the language the church uses. The church doesn't use the language of prayer to the saints. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it's not going to say prayer to the saints. Instead, it's going to talk about asking the saints for their intercession. And we are asking them to be our prayer partners. We're asking them to pray alongside of us in presenting God with our needs and requests. Of course, we pray to God too. We're asking them to pray alongside of us, just like we ask other Christians here on earth to pray alongside of us. I've written a lot about this, and we have a lot of resources about this at Catholic.com. So I would suggest Googling Jimmy Akin, that's my name, Jimmy Akin praying to the saints, and a bunch of stuff will appear. You can also go to Catholic.com and type in Praying to the Saints, and a bunch of resources will pop up for free for you to review. So I would suggest going to that for more information.
Daryl, thank you very, very much. It's open forum. Jimmy Aiken is our guest. Vince in Fresno, California, listening on Catholic.com is next. Vince, thank you for your patience. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. It's a pleasure to speak to you today. I think there was an old Death Valley Days episode on the King of America, if I remember right, from years and years ago.
Oh, I have to look that up.
Could be.
Apart from that, you know, I retired a couple of years ago, so I'm not able to listen to you on the radio every day like I used to at my computer terminal. But I've been wanting to ask you a question for a long time now about something I thought I heard you say years ago when you were talking about your Aramaic studies. And I've repeated this, so I wanted to double-check that I heard you correctly. What I thought I heard you say was that there was an Aramaic word for God that was pronounced Allah, which, of course, sounds like the Arabic word for God.
Well, Jimmy's got the question. We got to take a quick break. Right back with the answer on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, What is God? Examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of What is God today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Yep, I looked it up. Death Valley Days, 1956, Emperor of America. It's on there. Vince in Fresno wants to know about the Aramaic word for God. Go ahead, Jimmy.
So by any chance, Sykela, do you happen to know the Hebrew word for God? Just the generic word that means God.
Oh, wait. Not the Tetragrammaton.
Not the Tetragrammaton. That's a personal name.
Oh, L?
L, correct. L is the Hebrew word for God. You will also sometimes encounter it in the form Elohim, but the root word is El. And so in Hebrew, they also have a definite article, an equivalent of the word the. And so if I am talking about a king, I would say Melech. But if I'm talking about the king, I would say Ha-Melech. Okay. So Ha is the Hebrew equivalent of the word the. So if I, now one of the things that scholars have found about the development of languages is, you know, things will proceed with kind of like minor changes, but then very rapidly something can happen that will completely flip how things are done. And like, just the kids just decide to go with this new way of doing things in a generation, and you can have a sudden major shift in a language. Now, one of the things about the way Hebrew works is the definite article, the equivalent of the, gets put on the front of the word it's making definite. So if I'm like, once again, with the example for king, Melech, if I want to make that definite and say not just king, but the king, it's Ha Melech. And so the definite article goes on the front of the word. But that's not the only place you could put it. You could put it on the end of the word too. And at some point in the development of Aramaic, that seems to have been what happened. So instead of saying Ha Melech, you would say it the other way around, Melech Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, in Aramaic, now Aramaic and Hebrew are not the same language, but they're in the same language family.
Okay.
Kind of like English and German. But it looks like in Aramaic, what happened is the definite article that originally was on the front of the word got transposed to the end. And so very frequently, words in Aramaic are the same as the word in Hebrew, but with the added syllable ah at the end instead of ha. And so the Hebrew word for God being El, the Aramaic word for God is Allah. And that'll get pronounced a little bit differently depending on which Aramaic accent and dialect is being used. But yeah, Allah or Elah is the Aramaic word for God. And it's also the Arabic word for God. So Allah, or Allah, as we would pronounce it with an English accent, is just the Arabic word for God. It's used for God by not just Muslims. It's used by Arabic-speaking Christians, too. Arabic-speaking Christians talk about the true God as Allah. And Jesus, speaking in Aramaic, would have talked about God as Allah. And it's also the word for God in other languages, too, like Malaysian Christians will use Allah for God because that's just the word for God in their language. So people often who are English speakers who don't have much background in these other cultures will often get tied up in knots as if Allah is the name of a particular deity, the way Yahweh is the name of a particular deity. And Allah is not that way. It just means God. Like Gott means God in German, and Deus means God in Latin. Allah is the word for God in Aramaic and Arabic and Malay and some other languages. But a lot of Americans are only familiar with English. You know, there's a joke in linguistic circles. Cy Kellett, what do you call a person who speaks two languages?
Bilingual.
What do you call a person who speaks three languages?
Trilingual.
What do you call a person who speaks only one language? Lingual. That's right, an American.
That's us. That is us. Vince, that satisfy you?
Yeah, that's great. One last thing, Jimmy. Is that where did the Muslims just pick that up out of the Aramaic, or coincidentally, did they just use the same word?
It's sort of neither. Arabic is a member of the same language family that Aramaic and Hebrew are members of. It's the Northwest Semitic language family. And so they have a lot of words that are cognates. So originally, early on, there was an earlier language that Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic all developed out of. So it's not a coincidence that the word is related in these languages, but it's not the case that one language borrowed the word from another. So to give maybe a clarifying example, so English, German, and Dutch are all three members of the same language family. It's the Germanic branch of Indo-European. And so it's not a coincidence. If you find a word in English It will. There's likely to be a word in German and a word in Dutch that are very similar to it, because English, German, and Dutch are all descended from an earlier language. So it's not a coincidence that that these words are similar, but it's also not the case that, oh, one had to borrow from another. You know, English did not borrow from modern German, and modern German did not borrow from modern Dutch, and modern Dutch did not borrow from modern English. There's an earlier language that all three were influenced by.
Vince, thank you very, very much. Going to keep moving because there are lots of folks on the line. It is open forum. Jimmy Aiken is our guest going to Midland, Texas. Ryan, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Ryan, welcome back.
I hear y'all well. Don't worry.
Okay, very good.
All right, I want to ask you, Jimmy, why does the Gospel of John lack an institution of the Eucharist narrative, whereas the three synoptics and 1 Corinthians do have it?
I think it is because of the limitations that books had at the time. Books had to be hand copied. And it wasn't just the copyist that had to be paid, because the copyist needed materials to work with. He needed, you know, ink and a writing surface. The ink was cheap. You know, that was fairly easy to make. But the writing surface was much harder. The two kinds of writing surfaces they had for a book were papyrus. And papyrus is made from a reed that grows in Egypt. And there's a very complex process to take papyrus, the reed, and turn it into a sheet of what's effectively paper. The other writing surface they had for books was parchment, which is animal skin. And so you have to grow the animal, you have to kill it, you have to skin it, you have to treat the skin so that it becomes a suitable writing surface, like getting all of the hair off of it and smoothing it out so it'll be a good surface to write on. And so the paper alone was enormously expensive, because every sheet of it had to be handmade, and it involved a really complex process. So the result was books in the ancient world, between the cost of the materials and the costs of the copying, were fantastically expensive. A single copy of the Gospel of Matthew, just Matthew, would have cost the equivalent of $2,200. So if you can imagine dropping $2,200 just for Matthew, what that's going to do is put price pressure on books. You cannot make a super long book, or nobody will be able to afford it, or at least very few people will be able to. So if you want to tell the story of Jesus, you need to keep it down to a certain length. And even then, only the rich people are going to be able to buy it. And rich people and churches where people pool their money. So there is price pressure on the length of ancient books. And that's why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all about the same length as a typical scroll that you could buy commercially. They were trying to tell the story of Jesus in just one scroll. Now, in the case of John, if you do a careful study of John, it becomes clear John knows about the synoptic tradition. He knows that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or at least some of them, were out there. In particular, it looks like John has written his gospel in such a way as to interlock with Mark's. So the British scholar Richard Baucom has written about this. I also did a study of this that's at jimmyaiken.com. But it looks like John is consciously filling in things that Mark didn't mention. And he also clarifies some things that Luke mentions, because there are some unique things that are unique in Luke among the synoptics, but then John gives an expanded account of the same thing to help clarify what Luke was talking about. So it looks like John has what is called supplemental intent. He knows about the synoptics, at least he knows about Mark and Luke. Matthew is more questionable, but he certainly knows about Mark and Luke, and he's trying to supplement what they said. But if he then included everything that they said, his gospel would become unreasonably long. And so he, what he has to do, if he wants to supplement them by clarifying things they said or by including stories they didn't include, he's got to sacrifice something else. He's got to find something and cut it in order to make room in his gospel for all the new material he wants to use. And so as a result, he will allude to things in the synoptic gospels that he won't go into. He won't preserve an account of it. So like he talks about the Last Supper. I mean, he's got a big long thing about the Last Supper. It's like chapters 13 to 17. But he doesn't mention, oh, and this was a Passover. Instead, he focuses in his account of the Last Supper on things that aren't mentioned in the synoptics, like the foot washing and what Jesus said and the conversations and the prayers that Jesus gave during this event. So he knows, oh, Matthew and Luke have already recorded, or Mark and Luke have already recorded the institution narrative, so he's going to omit that. But he's going to talk about what Mark and Luke didn't cover, like the foot washing and so forth. He also has an extended meditation on the Eucharist in John 6. So he expects you to know about the Eucharist, but because you've already read the Synoptic Gospels, he's not going to repeat the institution narrative for you. You already know that. So what he's going to do is give you something you don't know, which is, here's Jesus's thought about the Eucharist in the extended bread of life discourse in John 6.
And I think we will have to leave it there because it's time for the break. But thank you so much for that question, Ryan. We'll take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Save the date. Saturday, August 26th is the day, and Birmingham, Alabama is the place for the 2023 EWTN Family Celebration. We're celebrating Mother Angelica's love for the Eucharist, and join us to mark the centennial year of Mother's birth. Make your plans now to attend this free event. More details coming soon at our Family Celebration webpage, ewtn.com/family celebration.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guests, Open Forum. Lots of folks online. Not lots of minutes left on the clock. So off we go to Madison, Wisconsin. David watching on YouTube. David, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Sign, Jimmy. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, can I hear you?
Sweet. So I understand that Mary and Jesus both experienced temptations. But mm-hmm. since they did not have concupiscence, does that mean that it was easier for them to resist temptation? And for us, since we do have concupiscence, is our will kind of like crippled to make us more prone to sin than they were?
Okay, so we should, I'm trying to think the easiest way to answer this without defining a lot of terms. What we have that they did not have is disordered desire. So that's what concupiscence is, as it's ordinarily understood today. Concupiscence is a disordered desire. And we have concupiscence as a result of original sin. Jesus does not have it because he didn't have original sin. He's the infinite, all-holy Son of God. And Mary didn't have it because God gave her freedom from original sin early in order to make her a fitting mother for his son. So they did have desires, but not disordered desires. And if you want to refer to those desires as temptation, I think that you run the risk of potentially confusing people. So I don't know that I would say they had temptation. I can imagine situations where, you know, their desires would be triggered, you know, like if people naturally get hungry, you know, that doesn't mean you're being tempted by food. It just means you're hungry. And since they didn't have disordered desires, I would be disinclined to refer to what they had as temptation. There is, of course, the account of Jesus being, quote unquote, tempted in the desert, but I don't think that's actual temptation. I think what's the same term in Greek that gets translated tempted there can also be translated tested. And I think that's a better English description of what's going on. I think the devil is testing Jesus to see if he can make him fall or not, because if he can make him fall, then he's not the Son of God. So the devil's putting pressure on Jesus to test him. But since Jesus has only ordered desires, like hunger after having fasted for 40 days, which, by the way, is totally biologically possible. People can fast for much longer than 40 days if you're in good health. But I wouldn't personally describe it as Jesus being tempted. So as a result of not having disordered desires, Mary and Jesus, I would say, certainly had an easier time than we do in terms of doing the right thing. That doesn't mean it was always easy to do the right thing. You know, Jesus went to the cross and that wasn't easy, but he didn't have a temptation to sin. And we do have a temptation to sin. We have broken, disordered desires that would lead us to sin because of the fact we have inherited original sin, which Jesus and Mary did not.
David, going to leave it there because, as I said, not a lot of time left. I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. Peter watching on YouTube. Peter, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. Thank you for taking my call. So I'm Catholic, and in my Bible study, we were reading Gospel of Matthew. And in chapter 13, 24, where he has the parable of the weeds among the wheat, we were discussing how Calvinists could interpret that to be evidence for double predestination and different ways to counter that. I was wondering if Jimmy had any thoughts on that.
Well, if someone said that the parable of the wheat and the weeds, or the wheat and the tares, as it's sometimes translated, is evidence for double predestination, I would say I don't think that you can get that out of this text. I mean, just read it. It says, and another parable he put before them, saying, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds also appeared. And the servants of the householder came and said to him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then has it weeds? He said to them, an enemy has done this. So the doctrine of double predestination holds that God picks some individuals. This is the Calvinist understanding of it. God just picks some individuals arbitrarily, not because of anything they've done. He just picks certain people and says, this person's going to heaven. And he picks other people and says, that person's going to hell. Not for anything, you know, there's no reason for God's choice. He just picks people and then determines that they will do the things needed to either go to heaven or go to hell. So, Sykelet, on the understanding of double predestination, who is responsible for the fate of the individuals that go to heaven, and who is responsible for the fate of the individuals that go to hell?
Well, they are in their choices.
No. What party is responsible? Who makes the choice of who's going to heaven and who's going to hell?
Jesus judges them.
Well, that's the judgment, but we're talking predestination. So who makes the choice?
I'm sorry that I don't feel like I'm getting what you're asking me about who. I mean, God's choice is that they should go to heaven.
There you go. That's the answer. Oh, okay. God's choice. God picks both the people who are going to heaven and the people who are going to hell. Everything else is an outworking of that predestinating choice. So God is responsible for both. Now, let's look back at the parable of the wheat and the tares, or the wheat and the weeds. In the parable of the wheat and the weeds, the householder clearly represents God, right?
Yes.
And the wheat represents the people who are going to go to heaven, whereas the weeds represent people who are going to go to hell.
Right.
So who is the householder or God responsible for in this parable?
Those going to heaven.
Just those going to heaven. Yeah. He didn't put the ones who are going to hell here. He says an enemy put that. And if the enemy is anybody, that would be Satan. And so as a result, I don't think you can get double predestination out of this parable, because what it does is it shows us God is responsible for people who are going to go to heaven, but the devil, by his temptation, is responsible for people who are going to go to hell. That's not double predestination, because the parable does not attribute both destinies to God making the choice between them.
Peter, I hope that that's helpful to you, but I'm going to leave it there because I still have folks that I can get on the line with Jimmy, so I'm going to keep going and do that. Joseph's in Nashville, Tennessee, listening on 100.5 FM. Joseph, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys having me on, guys. I had a question about the Second Vatican Council. Not questioning whether it's legitimate, but you know, it seems like it was primarily a pastoral council, and maybe I'm wrong. I had read the constitutions, but I don't know it as well as you guys. So my question is, if that is the case, did Vatican II have to be an ecumenical council for it to have had the same kind of effects that it did for the worldwide church? Could the Pope even have just by himself opted, you know, to make those declarations and have the same effect? So it's more of an ecclesiastical question, but I would love any kind of advice or input you could give.
Okay, so the only reason that the documents of any ecumenical council have worldwide authority is because the Pope gives them that authority. And so, yeah, a Pope could have just personally written all of the documents of Vatican II and published them, and they could have the same force. But it's, number one, I should say, they're not just about disciplinary measures. They're also, there's a lot of doctrine in Vatican II, and there are some new doctrinal developments, but a Pope could have achieved that in principle by himself. He didn't need a council to do that in principle. But nevertheless, it's God's will that councils be held in some circumstances, like in the first century when the conflict was about, do you have to be circumcised in order to become a Christian and be saved? Well, Peter already knew the answer to that. He let Gentiles into the church. Paul already knew the answer to that. Barnabas already knew the answer to that. But it was God's will that they hold the council of Acts 15 to have a broader discussion of that question. And we know it was God's will because Paul says in Galatians that he went up to Jerusalem to that council by way of divine revelation. So a revelation came from God saying, go up, hold a council, and deal with this. And by doing that, they got everybody on the same page, and they had ideas emerge from their mutual discussion, like how do, like James contributed, like how do we get the Gentile Christians who don't need to be circumcised to get along with the Jewish Christians who have been hearing Moses preached in every city? Well, here are some guidelines that would help with that. They aren't matters of doctrine, but they'll help prevent Jewish Christians from being scandalized. And so even though in principle, Peter could have settled all this by himself, it was God's will that it be handled in this other way because it allowed for a bigger statement if you get everybody on the same page, and it allowed for creative discussions to occur that could bring out additional helpful ideas.
Joseph, thank you very much for that question. I appreciate that call. Thanks to everybody who called. Thank you, Jimmy Akin, for coming in here and giving us that very fine hour.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett. I'll give you another one tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's why I got confused today about that Simone was on. Okay, so Jimmy and Simone tomorrow. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.